It's time to talk about Las Vegas with Ira. Each week, Ira David Sternberg talks with the celebrities, entertainers, writers, and personalities who make Las Vegas the most exciting city in the world. And now, here's Ira.
It always surprises people that I meet when I tell them that jazz has been a part of the Las Vegas entertainment scene for decades. In fact, the Las Vegas Jazz Society has been part of the entertainment capital for half a century. The Society's 50th anniversary jazz celebration is taking place April 26th and 27th at the Winchester Dondero Cultural Center and Park. And one of the performers featured at the event is my guest, world-class guitarist, arranger, and composer Joe Lano, who is also a mainstay of the Las Vegas and West Coast music scene for 50 years. Joe will also be performing with his quartet at Vic's Las Vegas May 2nd and 3rd. And for more information on the 50th anniversary of the Las Vegas Jazz Society, you can go to lvjs.org, lvjs.org. And for Vic's, go to vicslasvegas.com. And you can contact Joe at jlano1944@gmail.com. Joe, welcome to the show.
How are you?
I'm doing well, except for the pollen, so that occasionally gets me stumbling and coughing and everything else, and my voice is slightly off. But other than that, it's been great. Well, delight to have you on. What brought you to Las Vegas originally?
Well, when I was very young, okay, I worked at the Latin Casino in New Jersey, across from Philadelphia. And I started playing for Steve Lawrence and Edie Gourmet there, and they asked me to come out to Las Vegas, you know, later in the, you know, not right away, about a year or so later. And I came out here, we're going to be at the Sands for 5 weeks. And at that time, I had two very sick parents that I had to take care of. And I was trying to find a place to get off the road where I could sit down and work and make a living and take care of them. In those days, this was the place. So I came out, and that's how I got here. And I never left.
1964, I think it was, right?
Well, no, the first time was 63 with a group. And then in 66, I moved out here.
Okay, I had 64 in my head, so that's why okay. I mentioned that year. So I was sort of close.
Yes, you are.
So, you talk about Steve Lawrence, and of course, Steve Lawrence and Edie Gourmet were quite the act in Las Vegas. Another person you played with in those days, too, is Frank Sinatra.
Yes, I have.
Did you work on any of his recordings in Hollywood?
No.
It's primarily his performances here in Las Vegas. Do you remember any particular interesting stories about your time with Sinatra? And he performed, obviously, at several different hotels over the decades.
Nothing that I can recall, because that whole Frank Sinatra thing was very, you didn't really have a relationship with him. He was very nice, very polite, would compliment you when you would play something that he liked, you know. But it wasn't like the kind of relationship where you were like, on the inside, so to
sure,
speak.
Sure. And well, he's also used to performing with a big orchestra, so there's a lot of people involved in backing him up, not only on the live performances, but in recordings in Capitol Records, etc. So that's understandable. Of all the performers you perform with, and I want to talk about your background growing up in Philadelphia too, but with all the performers that you performed with, or played with, I probably, otherwise I'm being redundant, with all the performers you played with, there we go, now I got it right, was there one that stood out for you in terms of their talent, their presentation, their stage presence, the all-around gift that they had?
Yeah, I would have to say it was Lena Horne. You know, she was kind of unique because, like most performers that do a show, they have a set order of 12 tunes, 14 tunes, whatever it is, okay? And they kind of like do that same show for 6 months or, you know, whatever, wherever they go. With Lena, she did the same thing, but she would never sing the songs the same way twice because she was a product of her environment. So if she had a bad day today, she'd come on the stage and she'd kind of have like kind of like a bad attitude, which reflected in her singing. But then when she had a good day, it was another way. She would sing that tune another way. And when you work for somebody that's doing one-on-one where it was just her and I, she would actually literally make the hair stand up on the back of your head because she generated so much energy in her performance. And you never know what to expect. And it was like a challenge to follow her, you know, and play for her. And I never got that from any other act, no matter how good they were. That's my opinion. Okay.
Sure. Oh yeah. No, absolutely. Well, that gets us some insight. I know there was a book written, a biography written about her about 10 years ago, roughly. That was pretty good. And it talks about her background. Did you share time with her off stage? You mentioned before Sinatra, where it was less personal, but did you spend time with her off stage?
Yeah, absolutely. You know, when we would travel on the road, she was a sci-fi freak, the movies, you know, and so was I. But we'd be on the road and she would like call me in my room and says, Joe, they're showing The Creature from the Black Lagoon tonight. Come on down to room. Yeah. So we hang out, you know, and not only with me. I mean, she was like that with all the guys, you know. So there was a special thing about her, you know, because she was not only great on the stage, she was very down to earth off the stage, you know.
It's funny, you don't, when I think of Lena Horne, I don't equate her with science fiction or any of those films, but she obviously she enjoyed it. So did she ever talk to you about Star Trek or?
No, she just liked the old, you know, movies of the 50s, you know, that, you know, Creature from the Black Lagoon,
right.
Aviators, Spill, you know, all those things, which I did too at that time, you know, because that was part of our growing up, at least mine, you know.
Sure. That's funny. When you mentioned earlier about moving to Las Vegas and to take care of your parents, which is a noble thing too, were you able to, in those days, because of your background already in music, were you able to get work right away?
Yeah, see, well, that's quite a story there, but I'll tell you generally. So when I decided to move, okay, I wrote the Las Vegas Union, okay? And I explained to them and I sent doctor's notes and proof that I was supporting 2 6 people. I was coming out with Steve and Edie at the Sands, and I would like to get permission to work while I was on transfer because I couldn't afford to be out of work because I had this obligation. And
that's just for our listeners and viewers, that's Joe's dog that's making that noise.
Yeah, right. Anyway, I wrote to the union, and the reply I got back from them was, well, when you get here, please come. You'll come before the board and plead your case, and we'll give you every courtesy to try to help you with that. Okay, so I went there and pleaded my case, and they gave me permission to work on transfer. So I was working at the Sands already, and Antonio Morelli, who was the band leader then at that time, he liked my work. So I said to him, Antonio, I says, for what it's worth, the union gave me permission to work on transfer. So the next thing I know, he gives me Dean Martin, and then he gives me, Jerry Lewis. He gives me Joey Bishop. He gives me, you know, all the Rat Pack and all this, you know. And in those days, you would have to sign a hiring form with the band leader. And it was like a written thing. And there was 3 copies. And one went to the union, one went to the band leader, and one went to you. So, and the thing with the union in those days, when you were on transfer, you'd have to go down every week and sign in. Okay, so I start working. I finish with Steve and Edie. Next act comes in, I'm playing Jerry Lewis or whoever, you know, and then the next act comes in and I'm there about 9 weeks or something. And I get a phone call from the union, and the union call, the union says to me, he says, are you working at the Sands? And I said, yeah, I am. And I says, and he says, well, you're not supposed to be working there. You're a transfer member. And I says, yeah, I understand that. I said, but I went before the board. You gave your permission to work. No, he didn't. You have to understand that if they got the hiring form, they knew I was there, and it didn't take them 9 weeks to figure that out. Okay. So you got to come down here. We have to talk to you. So now it looked like a scene out of Dragnet, you know, the light, and you know, and we're going back and forth. And I said, he says, well, you're not supposed to be working there. I said, well, you gave me permission. And he says, well, no, we never did. So I said, well, if you just pull the minutes for the, from the meeting on such and such a date, you'll see that you did. We don't have to pull the minutes. We know you're going to give you that. I said, well, and we're going around now and round and round. And I says, look, I says, you say that you didn't give me permission. I'm telling you that you did. So I says, we're getting nowhere. So I says, I'll tell you what. I says, I'll leave the Sands. I says, but I says, tell you something right now. I says, if anything happens to my mother and father as a result of what you did here today, I said, I'm going to personally come down here and I won't finish that. But anyway, so now I went to Antonio Morelli's house because they had told him that I didn't have permission. They knock on the door and his wife answers the phone, I mean the door, and you can look into the house, and Antonio was in the back in the kitchen. You could see him in there. And his wife says to me, Antonio doesn't want to speak to you. Right?
Hey.
And I saw him, so I pushed her out of the way with the door, and I walked in, and I says, who the hell do you think you are that I have to lie to you for a job, okay? And then I laid it all out for him, and by the time I got done explaining to him what had happened, he called the musicians union, because he was very powerful in this town in those days, because he was part of the, you know, the mob, okay? Or he had a lot of connection to the mob. So he told him, he says, Joe Lano's going to stay at my hotel. He says, and you stay out of my hotel. When he got done with him, that was the end of it. Okay. But see, what had happened was when I got permission to work, everybody was working. Okay. I didn't know this. I figured it out later. Somebody became available during that time, a regular member, and they pitched the bits to the, you know, to the union. Excuse me for that, whatever. And so they said, well, I'm a member and you're giving this guy my job. So they had to make a, they had to, you know, more or less back off from him. So they wanted to get me off the gig to put him on the gig, you know. So anyway.
That's a great story. I didn't know about that. That's, and you obviously outlasted everybody because if you think about what the union went through in the 80s, where you had the issue of the strike, Caesar's Palace and the Tropicana and all of that as well. But I want to go back to something that I started to ask you, but I love that story you just told. You were born and raised in Philadelphia. Why did you decide that jazz was the music you wanted to play more than any other form of music?
Well, it just, when I was a kid, I don't know if you remember the old Dave Garraway show in the morning.
On the Today Show, yes. He was the host.
And I was like 10 years old. And I would get up in the morning, get ready for school, and that would be on. We'd have the TV on. And every day they would have a musical act on there. And they used to have a lot of jazz act on, you know. So Johnny Smith was on there, Tal Farlow was on there, you know, all these people on. And I just loved what I heard. So, you know.
And it was jazz. So you said, okay. But you started with music at an early age. You were playing guitar, I think, when you were 10, right?
Yeah. And I was playing in clubs when I was 12 and a half.
Amazing. How were you able to do that, be able to perform in clubs when clubs were for adults? I guess they just worked it out, right?
In Philadelphia, Pennsylvania had a thing where if you had a Social Security card and you were 16 and had a Social Security, you could work in a club. So my father lied about my age.
Okay, now I see.
I was a big kid, husky.
Right.
And of course nobody really cared because I could play the music and they didn't care if I was
exactly.
But anyway, that's how I got into there. And being responsible for two parents, I never really had the opportunity to say, hey, I'm going to pack up and go to LA and make it in the thing. And, this and that. So it was kind of like this was the place where I was making a living. So I played jazz kind of as a sideline, like they do now,
Sure.
I played a lot of jazz acts. I went on jazz cruises and all that stuff, but nothing really steady where I made a living from it. And of course, nowadays it's even worse. There's less show work, there's less jazz work, there's less, a lot of stuff,
Because obviously you can perform any kind of music, and that's one of the abilities of musicians that can perform in showrooms up and down the strip at a time when there were all these shows going on. And jazz, I would think that jazz for you, and correct me if I'm wrong, jazz for you is the passion part of your playing more than any other form of music. Would that be fair?
Yep, absolutely. And back in those days also, they had, I don't know if you were here then, do you remember Alan Grant's?
So you got the Four Queens.
Alan Grant's. Jazz, right? Okay. Well, I used to play there a lot with different acts, different artists, okay? I played the Riv on Don Menz's band. They had another Monday night thing happening there. Anyway.
But the irony, though, with the Alan Grant and the Four Queens is that one of the regular performers there may not have been at the same time as you were there, but probably was Frank Sinatra Jr.
Yeah, but he wasn't on the Monday Night Jazz. He was in the room the other six.
Right, but it was the same venue.
In that sense.
So do you ever bump into Frank Sinatra Jr. at all when you were down there?
I worked for him, too.
Okay. Yeah, Frank Sinatra Jr. is an interesting... unfortunately, he has passed away, but he was always fascinating to me. I worked with him on a couple of projects, and he's been on my show several times over the years. Very bright, very, very bright.
Absolutely. Yeah.
Just knew everything. So how did you first get involved with the Jazz Society itself? Was that in the early?
I knew Monk Montgomery.
Okay.
And I did a couple of things back then with him. And then they heard me at the Four Queens, and different people heard me. And then I had got a reputation to start playing these things on Monday nights. And it's like anything else. It's a business of the word getting around.
Sure, and people that know of you over time, especially when you moved to Las Vegas, which was way before I moved here. But when you moved here, it was a relatively small town.
It was great.
And you had a chance, other than the issue with the musicians union, you got to know people, a lot of people very quickly, because it wasn't a huge city as it has become. We call it a town now, but it's more of a city in a sense. You have Clark County in Las Vegas, not to get in the weeds here, but in other words, in the time when you moved here, you were able to, it was a special time, and you were able to make a mark very early on because of that.
Mm-hmm. Well, back in those days, I can tell you right now that, first of all the hotels were set way back off the strip. And when you pulled into the driveway, you felt like you were pulling into a resort rather than a gambling establishment. as opposed to what's happened now, okay? Everything's built right up to the street. In the lounges, they have music 24 hours a day. And at night, each of those lounges had a big band act, just the way they had in the showroom, okay? And then they would have a couple of small groups, quintet, this and that, and then all, you know, they would shift. There would be shifts where different people would come on, but there was like three bands a day playing in all these hotels, okay? So it was very easy to get a job to the point where, like, if you got fired today, 5 minutes from now, you'd be hired somewhere else. I mean, I'm serious. That's the way it was. There was so much back then, so few people here, you know? So it was a great town.
What would be a good reason to fire someone in those days? Is it just a personality conflict kind of a thing? And then the next band leader would be okay with the person that got fired by the first band leader?
You know, musicians are, for the most part, are driven by their egos, you know, and a lot of them can't take criticism. Okay, so, you know, you get a band leader that they don't respect, and the guy says something to you, you know, a lot of these guys would mouth off, and they get fired. The band leader has the gig, you know, he's got the right to say anything to you that he wants. You know, so, and unfortunately, you know, that ego that these musicians would have would cost them their job.
But then they'd get hired down the block by.
Right. Well, that was the reason why they could afford to have an ego.
Yeah, exactly. Good point. Yeah.
Yeah.
Did you ever think of being a band leader? I know you have the quartet, and we mentioned about the fact that you're going to be performing not only at the Jazz Society, but at the VIX Las Vegas May 2nd and 3rd with the quartet. So did you ever think about wanting to be a band leader beyond a quartet? In other words, a 36-piece orchestra or something like that?
No, I would rather write for that than I would be in conductor. Okay. That's, you know, and I've done a lot of that, you know, a lot of writing, still do. When I left the Sands, I got a call to do the Casino de Paris show. I don't know if you remember that. Do you remember that?
Yes. Casino de Paris. There, at that point, there were so many of these big production shows. You had the Folies Bergère, Lido de Paris, Casino de Paris, et cetera, et cetera. So there was quite a laundry list of big productions with showgirls, mostly.
Yeah. So anyway, what happened with that was that Frederick Apcar and his wife, who owned the show, got a divorce. But they still had equal shares in the show. They kept their business arrangement. And she wound up having a boyfriend from Paris who was a great musician, okay, a young guy. And he was going to write this Casino de Paris show because for years, Bill Reddy wrote the shows there. So he comes in, and the band leader was Earl Green. And Earl Green's taking him all over town, seeing the shows, to unbeknownst to anybody, to pick out the musicians that he wanted, because he had very special music. Okay? So he would tell him, I want this guy, I want that guy. Okay. So I get a phone call, and part of the deal was you had to play for him, you know, play something for him, because he wanted to know how much he could write for you. In other words, how difficult you can handle. Well, I went in and I played him some stuff, and he wrote a book. Each of those books in that band were written for the guy that played it, okay? And also, a lot of the stuff that he wrote was in weird time changes. The first show we played, the opening tune was in 11/4 time, okay? You say, what is that? No. But the way he did it, it really swung, you know, so it was a challenge and interesting. But the only problem was that in those days they had the shows run 7 days a week, 7 nights a week. So on the seventh day, they would have a relief band come in. Well, because he wrote this book that only I could play, they couldn't get a replacement. So I worked for 7 nights a week for 2 years without a day off. And just about went nuts. Okay, so.
Yeah, I can't imagine 2 years of 7 nights a week.
Right. And then
was that two shows, Joe, or one show a night?
That was two shows a night.
Oh, man.
And these shows were 2 hours long. They were long shows, okay? And finally, I finally got some time off, okay? And I took my wife and we went to Hawaii, okay? And when I came back, I had to go down to the show the night before to make this and that. Band leader, instead of saying to me, well, did you have a good time? You know, enjoy yourself. I hope you enjoy yourself. Okay? He says to me, if you weren't a friend of mine, I'd fire you right now. That's all I had to hear.
Yeah.
So I quit. Okay. I quit. And about 5 minutes later, I got hired to do the Desert Inn. Right.
Back to your story about quitting one thing and or getting fired and all of a sudden you're at another one. Yeah.
So then what happened there is that he tried to hire somebody and couldn't find anybody to play the second edition of the show that John Lexier wrote. Had this big guitar thing in the front in the opening number. Okay. And he says to me, would you come back? And I says, no, I'm not going to come back. I says, And he says, well, would you consider coming in and just playing the opening number? and because our show started at 7:45, okay? And the rest of the shows were starting like at 8:15 or something, whatever. So like for a good long time, I was doubling, okay? And they finally, as the additions got more and more additions, they lightened up on the parts. Okay. So that kept me busy and I was able to take care of business, but funny stuff you have to deal with.
That is a funny story and a great way to leave it. My guest has been world-class guitarist, arranger and composer, Joe Lano. He's performing at the Jazz Society's 50th anniversary jazz celebration, April 26th and 27th at the Winchester Dondero Cultural Center and Park, and also at Vic's Las Vegas, May 2nd and 3rd with the quartet. For more information on the Jazz Society, go to lvjs.org, lvjs.org. For Vic's, go to vicslasvegas.com. And for anything about Joe, you can go to jlano1944@gmail.com. jlano1944@gmail.com. Joe, thanks for being on the show.
Thank you. Appreciate it.
See you next time.
You've been listening to Talk About Las Vegas with Ira. Each week, Ira David Sternberg talks with the celebrities, entertainers, writers, and personalities who make Las Vegas the most exciting city in the world. Yeah.